I think our lesser selves brings a kind of perfectionism and judgment and harshness, but we find our freedom more in just accepting the gift of being alive in an imperfect world, in an imperfect body. But there's so much beauty in that imperfection too, so much capacity in those inclinations and differences that takes some courage, I think, to receive that in all its imperfection.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Hey everyone, I'm heading to Texas in March to host two date nights. The first will be in the Dallas area on March 27th, and the second will be in the Austin area on March 28th. I'll be discussing why passion fades in relationships and what couples can do to keep their relationships feeling alive. Click the link in the show notes to learn more. Hope to see you there.
Hello, you made it. I am so happy that you are here. My brain is busy and my heart is full. Today's podcast episode is titled ADHD Within Marriage with Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife. If you're a longtime listener to the Busy Brain Saint, you know how often I reference Dr. Finlayson Fife's work, often affectionately referring to her as JFF. And since we are sharing an ADHD podcast, I'll add that after buying multiple of her books at the Restore Conference, one arrived on my doorstep that I totally had forgotten that I pre-bought. And in true ADHD fashion, I am now very well equipped with your book, Dr. Jennifer.
That's
it's
awesome.
The most ADHD moment and happily ADHD moment, honestly, that I awesome. Have. Dr. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me today. This intersection of ADHD, faith, relationships, and in particular, sexuality is honestly one of my greatest passions. And I'm so deeply grateful for the chance to learn from you through this particular lens today. So thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Before I begin, I just want to briefly ground us in what maybe we mean when we say ADHD. So ADHD, which is now in the DSM-5 broken into three different parts, ADHD hyperactive, ADHD inattentive, which is formerly ADD, and ADHD combined, is a neurodevelopmental disorder involving delayed or different development of the prefrontal cortex and its connections to other brain regions, which are responsible for executive functioning, emotional regulation, impulse control, working memory, sleep-wake regulation, a lot of things, sustained attention. Because this is a brain-based difference, not a maturity issue or a motivation problem, ADHD doesn't disappear in adulthood, and it often presents differently in men and women, which is why it's so commonly misunderstood, especially in long-term relationships. And it's also what makes us, as a side note, some of the most dynamic, fun, creative, spontaneous, amazingly impulsive people on this planet, which can be very frustrating, but is also very beautiful. So Dr. Jennifer, with that as the foundation, I'd love to start with you here. As I'm learning from you, I'm already so impressed listening to Room for Two and different things, how unbothered you are when people say they have ADHD, but also how you don't dismiss it. You're always looking for the root of what the conflict is. Mm-hmm. And while we're zooming in, however, on this podcast about ADHD, this is my question. How do you most often see ADHD show up in long-term relationships, particularly around emotional and sexual connection?
Well, first of all, I would say that people tend to marry the person that's different than they are. And, you know, a lot of the gifts of someone that we might call ADHD are that they tend to be creative, spontaneous, you know, fun-loving, right? There's a kind of openness or freedom or spontaneousness that's often attractive to the person who is more regulated, more organized, more scheduled, just as the ADHD person may be attracted to that person, because there's a mystery in each and a complementarity in it and so on. And so that's not an unusual match for people. That said, the level of maturity within the couple can really determine whether or not that becomes a invigorating dynamic difference in the couple, or if it turns more into a one up, one down kind of relationship. Yeah. Where you have a caretaker energy from the more organized person, or kind of contempt from them, like, you know, what is your problem? Why did you forget that again? And a little bit of that kind of codependence.
Yeah.
And that the person who may struggle more with organization and so on, even though they have many other gifts, may actually underfunction or become resentfully dependent upon the more organized person. So, I mean, I'll say just one more thing about it. Couples always have differences, and they always have conflict around those differences to some degree or another. It's really how much dependency and resentment is in the couple is really the measure of maturation, not what those differences look like per se.
Yeah, I love observing that. Thank you. As I'm listening to you, coach, I think that's why you are so unbothered, because you're like, whether it's ADHD or OCD mm-hmm. or trauma mm-hmm. or whatever mm-hmm. it is, we still have a route to get to.
Yes.
And yet that doesn't have to exclude their lived experience. And I don't ever feel like you do that. But it does inform a little yeah. bit more. And I think that brings to my next question. What might be helpful for a person to know about themselves or a spouse to understand about their partner in those differences, maybe specifically to ADHD, that can help them move through this all-consuming challenge of humanity of in relationships, but specific yeah. to ADHD in the relationship?
Well, you know, as a therapist and a trained counselor, I mean, and just going through my training and learning the DSM well and things like that, you know, there's value in being able to label and group patterns of behavior, right? Like, what does ADHD look like? You don't go inside the brain and say, oh, this person has an ADHD brain. And we may get to a point where that is how we diagnose, is there's, we can understand there's a biology there, or of autism or of OCD. It's more on a constellation of behaviors, right? And even like personality assessments and so on. As humans, there can be real value in understanding, I tend to be more of a creative person. I tend to be more social. I tend to be more, you know, working with my hands and introverted. And those patterns can help us better understand what our gifts are, what our challenges may be. But of course, the risk of categorization is also that we then say, okay, well, it's not me, it's my ADHD. Or, well, let me go two directions. So on the one hand, it can be valuable, because then you can, as the partner of somebody who has ADHD, not be condescending and patronizing and judgmental, because you married someone who doesn't have the same strengths that you have. And if you can understand that constellation of behaviors, ideally have more compassion for and understanding for the fact that they move through the world differently than you do. We can also, though, go in the other direction, that once you have a label, use it to justify not taking full responsibility for yourself and your impact, not sorting out how am I going to deal with my OCD, depression, ADHD, yeah. whatever my challenge is, and instead use that perceived diagnosis as a way to justify a dependent or underfunctioning orientation to a marriage.
It sounds similar to when I've heard you speak about love languages, a similar yes. idea where, good, you know a little bit more about your spouse, and that's not a bad thing. And yes. also, it doesn't excuse you from the work of looking at self and looking at relationship and needing to work through things.
Yeah. And yeah. taking real responsibility for ourselves. That's really how I tend to think of it, because whether you have mental illness or patterns that you learn from your family of origin or a neurodivergence in some form, when it comes to an intimate relationship, the thing that allows us to be collaborative is when we really take full responsibility for the gifts and burdens of the body and mind and history that we were born into, that we are agents within it. And that's different than saying, oh, you're just choosing to forget the keys or whatever. That doesn't mean that, but that I really understand that I have an impact on others and I have an impact on my own life, and I have to sort out how am I going to deal with my particular gifts and challenges. And when we get in trouble in marriage is when we make that other people's responsibility, right? I can't do that because of my depression. I can't do that because of A, B, and C. And therefore, I'm justified in having other people manage me because of my supposed weakness.
So what is the reframe? So now let's maybe turn to the individual who has ADHD. So many of my clientele who have ADHD, in addition to people I've heard you work with numerous times, the shame is like unruly, right? We have a society that really values being on time, being organized, not forgetting your kid's recital. And so we then attach that to who we are as a person, and yet our working memory often just doesn't show up for us the same way. And in taking responsibility and looking at those parts of self that are honest and actually true, what's the reframe to maybe help someone with ADHD be honest and self-confronting without indulging in the shame?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I think we live in a time that exposes the liabilities of ADHD in a way that perhaps would have been less apparent 100 years ago or 200 years ago. I mean, I don't know. This is the only time period I've lived in, but I think we live in a time that is inundated with information and distractions. And so the ability to navigate and manage that, I think, is especially challenging. Like if you had ADHD, but you're working on a farm, okay, well, you know, there's a routine to it and so on. It's probably be easier to not even know or think of yourself in that way, you know, because
in fact, it could be a strength, I would imagine,
right,
in some ways.
Absolutely, yeah. Could be, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think that sometimes having compassion for ourselves, that there is somewhat of a mismatch. The other thing I would say is that a lot of us are becoming more ADHD in our current environment because our information environment is set up to distract us and to take our attention. Yeah. And so a lot of us that actually were better able to focus 10 years ago find ourselves not actually getting around to reading a book, not doing things that require long focused attention because our phone dings and, you know, there's just distractions everywhere. So I think that sometimes better understanding there's a mismatch, and I need to figure out how to have some compassion and grace for who I am. And so, you know, I remember hearing a story once of a young girl who just could not focus in her class and her grades were poor and she didn't enjoy school. And then they brought her, they were talking to her parents and she was in a room just behind a two-way mirror or whatever, so she couldn't see that her parents and teachers went on the side. And she was there dancing and twirling and so on. And the teacher or somebody there was saying, this girl's in the wrong environment. This is not the right learning environment for her. She's a dancer. She's a creative, artistic person. And actually, she did get put into a dance school and she became a professional dancer, actually. This is just a story that a psychologist that I was learning with was telling. And so that is to say, like, when we find where we belong, we can find a lot of joy in being able to develop and express our gifts. And if we're in the wrong setting, if we're a creative type and we're trying to be an accountant, we may just be miserable all the time. And so is there some way I need to address the match between my environment and what my gifts are? And then to understand that those gifts, and I think this is true for all of us, like as my husband has said, you know, that our virtues and our vices are made out of the same stuff. And so very often the very things that are our gifts are also the things that are troubling for us in other settings and at other times. And so how can I receive these gifts of the body and brain I've been born into, work with the limitations in it? I think that's what we're all up against at some level, and take responsibility for the limitations as best I can. Like, I think in marriage, when people do better, there is a sense that, you know, my spouse cares about this challenge of hers or his. They really are taking measures to limit their negative impact, even though they still may fall into it, just as I fall into my lesser self at times too. So there is both a deep sense of responsibility for ourselves on both sides and some forgiveness for the humanity that's always going to be there in every human relationship.
The value that people are placing in society on the specific things that many people with ADHD struggle with is kind of just someone's opinion to a degree, is kind of what I'm hearing you saying. And when we can shift and see that we're all beautifully flawed and all going to fall short in a degree,
yeah,
then it's less threatening to maybe see those parts of ourselves, and
yes,
becomes even endearing sometimes. My husband and I can just laugh together sometimes now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when funny things happen, like, well, that makes sense. Like, that's
yeah,
how your brain doesn't show up for you sometimes, and things will
yes,
work out.
And things are okay.
Right?
And I love
yeah,
who you are. And I love, you know, yes, exactly. Like Temple Grandin, who is a woman who is autistic, who developed, well, because she would get so overwhelmed growing up, like she learned that if she could get squeezed, it would help her nervous system calm down. And so then she developed this for the animals that were being slaughtered, you know, for McDonald's. So she basically created something that would calm the animals. I mean, yeah, what I heard her speak once, my son and I went and listened to her, yeah, and cool, and she just basically, her thesis was, you know, well, first of all, she said, my mom knew, could see who I was, and she challenged me around my limitations. She would yeah, push me to be in environments where I had to learn to interact with people. I had to learn how to pay for things at the store, do things that were way outside of my comfort zone. But she wasn't doing it as a rejection of me. She was doing it to help me keep developing where I was weak, because it was going to broaden my capacity as a human being. But what she also said was, my mother had a lot of love and acceptance for exactly who I was. And so I knew that who I was its own gift. And so her basic thesis of her talk was, the world needs all kinds of minds. Right? We really do. Like, there are some minds that better understand how to solve problems than other minds, that know how to innovate things that we need more than other minds, that know how to organize things more than other minds. And learning, you know, to be in the body of Christ is to learn to say, like, these are my gifts and I want to develop them and express them well, while allowing my limitations to keep me humble and receptive and growing, and to understand we're all in this together and we're bringing different gifts, and to not have contempt for ourselves or each other. That's our spiritual goal, I think.
There's the stereotype that ADHD means impulsivity, high sex drive, mm, desire, arousal, instantaneous arousal, that it's just everything is just very trumpet-like, just, you know, spontaneous. What might you have to say about that surrounding perception?
Some people with ADHD, of course, are the impulsive type, and then there's also the inattentive type. So there's really...
Oh, yeah, or they get distracted during sex is a whole other thing, right?
Yes, yeah, it can be that, yeah, too. But then there's another factor that I think sometimes gets named as ADHD, but is in fact more about anxiety. So because sex is so intimate and exposing and revealing, people can often be more distracted, more impulsive, more avoidant in sex than they might be in any other context, right? And so it's important to not make something be about a neurological attention issue if it's actually related to anxiety, validation pursuit, exposure, right? Because
yeah,
that is another thing. Like, there's a lot of people, you know, the kids that might be having a struggle with attention, for example, or even impulsivity at school, and a psychiatrist might be trying to sort out, is this about attention or is this more about anxiety? Is this a kid who's having a hard time settling down because of things that are going on at home? Or is this child avoidant and struggling you know, to stay on a task because of executive function issues, or are they anxious about failure, right? And so is this more of an anxiety response? And so there's a lot of these factors that might be playing in, because if you have some ADHD, but you're very kind of grounded in your development, right, you might really be able to channel your attention and channel your loyalty and channel your focus, right, in something as meaningful as sex. So I would never say, you know, well, somebody who struggles to be faithful must have ADHD. I mean, but I would be interested, is there a self-regulation challenge that is a big factor in this person's life that has really interfered with their ability to kind of have a pause between an impulse and a decision? And so it's just maybe not taking a simple lens to anything, or a simple, you know, I guess my goal in working with people is to have enough self-understanding that facilitates their responsibility and their ability to be a chooser in their lives. Self-understanding can facilitate it, and it can also disrupt it. So it's like, what is actually driving the impulsivity, for example? Yeah. How much is it about intimacy avoidance? How much is it about a general dysregulation challenge? And, you know, how can this person work with themselves to forge the life they want?
Thank you so much. I know that's why you're so effective, is you give people their choice back, right? You allow them to see what's actually real. And sometimes that is looking at self. What is your out-of-box programming with the kind of brain you have? Now that you know that, what's next? You know, yeah. What is the other piece of yourself that actually needs looking at that you're thinking is ADHD, your impulsivity or your working memory or whatever? Now that you know, yeah, how to manage that, what can we look at now? And that's the human condition. Couples where one partner struggles to stay present during sex, which we kind of talked about, how do you help them understand what is neurological versus what is relational? Talked about that, but maybe restating it through that lens of,
yeah,
there is a neurological factor here. We don't need to dismiss it, but it is in relationship to maybe a bigger issue even.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't think of myself as I always know, because a lot of times I don't know. I don't know, is this person doing the best that they can or not? You know, I have a child that's on the autism spectrum, and sometimes I feel like I under-challenged him growing up, and in other places maybe was over-challenging or assumed he could do things that I would forget, like, no, this kid actually has a challenge, and I keep forgetting and kind of just assuming he would be just like his siblings. So I think that's always kind of an open question, like, and a lot of times we don't even know as the person ourselves, like, sometimes I feel like professors that challenged me, like when I was like, you got to be kidding me. I cannot do that. And then I would end up doing it, like
doing
pushing
it.
Through, and then be like, totally. Wow, that was the best class I've ever taken, you know, because it pushed you to grow in a way you didn't expect you could. So life is challenging that way, because, you know, you don't want to just throw everybody in the deep end and the ones that like survive or the, you know, whatever, you know, you want to challenge optimally, and that's not always easy to know. But if I were working with someone who had both ADHD and seemed very anxious around sex, what I would be thinking about is I want to first deal with the anxiety and just see what they can address, like what's going on in the relationship, what's going on in their sense of self, how do they try to calm down, what helps them settle themselves. If they were to be more settled in their intimate relationship next to their spouse, just being there, if they got better at settling their body and their mind, how would that shape their attention? Would it facilitate something, right?
Cool.
And could they be a little more forgiving and a little more gentle in inviting their attention back because they are challenging some of the self-contempt, you know? So it's not like, oh, I want to turn this person into a different person, but I want to help them deal with the normal human anxieties of intimate connection and see how that shapes their attention and their engagement and their ability to be in an open-hearted relationship. Hey everyone, on March 24th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, Camden is going to be joining me for a live Q&A session about neurodiversity in relationships. Neurodiversity brings a unique set of strengths and challenges to intimate relationships, And during this call, we will be using your questions to guide our discussion on how couples can create more peace, closeness, and partnership across neurological differences. Click the link in the show notes to learn how you can submit questions and join the call.
Many married couples that have been married for a while, or maybe not, maybe for a little bit of time, they often feel worn down by the ADHD cycle. There's promises, there's effort, there's broken promises, sometimes intentional, other times not. What can help couples rebuild hope after so many years of trying to intervene in this cycle without them being like delusional that, you know, just keep thinking positive, just keep working, keep trying. What is it that in your experience is a key or keys to helping people that maybe feel kind of hopeless with this have hope?
I think what I might want to do is challenge false hope, because false hopes, when we invest in false hopes, it tends to turn us to despair or cynicism. And so I would say my goal is to help people see things as truthfully as they can so that they have maximized their agency in a hard situation. What limits our agency is often trying to control things that we can't control or not controlling things that we can. And in couples, this often gets confused, especially when someone struggles in an overt way. That is, the partner of the person with ADHD or a substance abuse challenge or some kind of challenge often starts parenting or overfunctioning or filling in or going blind or being contemptuous and superior. They often, because they're being impacted by the other person's choices, start to try and control it, correct it, judge it. You know, they're in reaction to it. But effectively, they're trying to change the other person that they cannot change. And that's very human of us to do that. And what it is to grow up, I think, is to start recognizing I don't have control over whether or not my spouse gets better at this, deals with this. I only get to decide how I'm going to function relative to it, whether or not I'm going to continue to relate to them like a child, for example, or continue to judge them harshly, or continue to be here, or whatever it is I'm doing, I get to control that. So given that I can't control them, given that nothing I can do is going to make them be different, which is not saying that there's no chance that they may grow, but it's just not on me. If I can come to accept that, then what does that mean for me? What do I desire? Who am I going to be? What do I need to do differently within myself? How do I need to handle myself in this situation that I can respect? For some, that might mean this is a person who has a substance abuse problem who has no intention of dealing with it, and I can no longer be involved in it and feel at peace with myself, for example. That might be a response if you feel like this is more than I can genuinely accept. Or it may mean like I need to stop. I'm going to just accept that this is who I'm married to and stop condemning them, judging them, condescending to them. I'm just going to be more decent, right? And take deeper responsibility for myself, for example. When we're collaborative, we're 100% responsible for ourselves, and we take zero responsibility for what isn't ours to control. And to some, that sounds harsh, like, well, what about people's needs and serving them and not.
But in your truest self, oftentimes you would, right?
Yeah. Like, right. Exactly. So it doesn't mean that you don't have compassion, that right. You don't do something that might be helpful and kind and good, but you've let go of the fantasy that it's mine to solve, or there's something I'm going to do that's going to make them ... whatever the thing is you want. You've let go of that idea. The issue for me is who owns the problem. And whether or not we like it, we own the gifts and challenges of the situation that we have been given, right? Our bodies, our minds, our histories, our lives. And it's a gift and a challenge. And we all have that spiritual soul work to do. And the sooner we understand it as our work, and that doesn't mean we can't seek help and try to address our challenges and get the supports that might benefit us in dealing with our situation, of course. But we own the problem. We understand it is ours to address. That's what it is. And so in a loving marriage, you each take full responsibility for who you are and what your impact is and who you're going to be in this marriage. And when we get that cleared up, much stronger things happen in a marriage. But it is also scary.
It reveals the choice is what I'm hearing you say. Like you said that earlier on, that you're trying to help people regain their own agency.
Yes.
And if they're seeing life from a false perspective, something that actually isn't real, how can they ever actually choose?
That's right.
But what you're saying is when you're able to live in truth and see truth for what it is, all of a sudden your decision is, well, am I going to be willing to tolerate and work through and love and grow with this person? Or am I going to take the other choice? Is it really time to say, no, these are not things I want to attach myself to? But when we're not living in the reality, how do we ever have the honest choice to make?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
That is so important.
It's hard sometimes because we want the fantasy that we can get the other person to do what will make us happy or make us more comfortable or whatever, because we prefer that fantasy over the real responsibility of sorting out who we're going to be, what we're going to do. So it's sometimes hard to push ourselves on that question, but that is really where we get our strength. And that's where a relationship can get stronger.
And how helpful this has been, not only in my own marriage relationship, but with my relationship with my children. As they're entering the teenage years, it has just opened up this freedom to, you know, I can support and guide and give opportunity for. And of course, there's parts that require some kind of safety precautions that their brain hasn't quite developed into, right? But man, it really takes off this pressure. And when I'm living without the anxiety and the fear driving my bus,
yes,
all of a sudden I'm open to a more beautiful and more regulated and healthier version of myself that not only I enjoy more, but it seems that my spouse and my kids and everyone else says too.
Sure.
I love when you talk about you married a whole person.
Yeah, exactly.
That has become a very common theme in my house to say, I'm a whole person. And as I look upon my husband, who is, you know, the yin to the yang, 1,000%, things that I would subconsciously hope to change or hope that he would do differently, I can now reach out in my heart with love and appreciation for, because I married all of him, not just the parts that were like me. And I think that that is a beautiful thing to highlight as one of your philosophies or whatever you want to say here in neurodivergence, especially in couples that might have their own neuro differences.
Yeah.
Is that we married the whole person for a reason, which is right where you started.
Yeah, and learning to love ourselves and to love another, you know, in all of our fallibility and the ways that we disappoint ourselves and are disappointed, like to learn to love in the face of that is just really valuable work. And, you know, I think our lesser selves brings a kind of perfectionism and judgment and harshness, but we find our freedom more in just accepting the gift of being alive in an imperfect world, in an imperfect body. But there's so much beauty in that imperfection too, so much capacity in those inclinations and differences. And so, you know, that takes some courage, I think, to receive that in all its imperfection.
Awesome. I think one last question here is, having read your book, I participated in your book club. It was awesome. I felt like this book was the book that my teenage self that understood the beauty of my sexuality wanted to be written.
Yeah.
And you wrote it. And so on a personal note, I thank you for that. What do couples have to look forward to in surrendering to this work to a degree and being willing to try?
Yeah. So first I would say that probably the reason the book exists is because of my ADD.
Yay!
So that's just like, you know, I learned how to be a better student. Like, I learned skills that helped me keep my attention on what the professor was saying and things like that. So, you know, but when I was in grade school and high school, you know, the teacher would be up there, wah, 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 and my brain would just be like thinking, I'd maybe hear a sentence they said, and then I would take it and I'd be thinking about it. And I still kind of do that when I'm listening. You know, a lot of times I'll take it and I'll work with an idea and I'm not, you know, their thoughts are going past
Pause,
me.
Rewind, please.
So, you know, I used to feel really bad about that. I used to think like, why am I not like other students? Why is it so hard for me to pay attention? I mean, there's so many times where I'd be sitting in class looking out the window, thinking about something, and the teacher would be like, begin. And I'd be like, begin. What, you know, what are we doing? Anyway, so I think I did a lot of like, what's the matter with me? I'm not that intelligent kind of judgment. And, you know, but then as I followed what my passions were and the things I cared about, you know, there was like this ability to take and work with an idea and so on in that more creative brain, maybe, you know, is so much how I came into the work I'm doing. And so, you know, I have so many people I love who are very much in that direction, and they have started businesses, and, you know, just, I would say all my siblings have been kind of innovative, creative people in some degree, and several of my kids. So it's just, there's a lot of gifts in it and frustration. So those are true. So yeah. To your question of what do couples have to look forward to? Well, I would say that the longer I have lived and worked with couples and been myself married and grown in a marriage, that I've come to better appreciate the value and challenge of learning to really love and be loved, to have enough faith in goodness, even when we are always working within limitation and finiteness. Like, that is the balm. That is the anchor in a world of anxiety and uncertainty and agency. So I think that the more we can understand the project, sometimes we think it's perfection, sometimes we think it's flawlessness, sometimes we think it's making all the right choices so that we don't have to deal with suffering. And I think those are very normal desires, but not actually what is at the core of the soul work that we're engaged in. But when we can relate to marriage as a valuable place for developing our capacity to love and be loved, and when we can accept the gift of the body and sexuality, we can find a lot of beauty and sustenance in that relationship. I would even say something sacred in that relationship, not in a kind of sanitized way, but in a soulful way, that it kind of helps us to feel sustained in a world that has so much loss and darkness and uncertainty. So, you know, the book itself is really just offering many of the ways we have falsely learned about how to be in relationship to ourselves and our sexuality and each other, and what faith can offer us in giving us a vision of how we can grow and experience deeper joy, especially in marriage and in intimate love.
Thank you so much, Dr. Finlayson Fife. This is probably going to be a highlight of my life, having this conversation with you today. And I know it's going to bless and inform so many people's lives, specifically in our ADHD community. People are going to want to know more about you, especially those that might not know you already. Where would be the best place for them to find out about you and your courses, etc.?
Yeah, well, it's been a real pleasure to be here. My website is my last name, so finlayson-fife.com. And on there, there's just lots of resources. So there's my book, That We Might Have Joy. There is my podcast where I work with couples that's called Room for Two. I have online courses for couples and individuals to grow in their relationship to themselves and their sexuality and to be able to forge happier marriages and relationships. So it's all there if you get on the website.
And it works, guys. It works. And right now you're doing a lot of live events.
Yeah.
Which is pretty fun. Stay up to date with those, you guys, too.
Yeah, we've been doing more of the, now that the book is finished, we're trying to do less, well, not less necessarily of the 3-day events, but we've done many multi-day events and we're trying now to do some more kind of low cost 1-day and several hour workshops just to kind of help everybody have access that wants it.
Yeah. And I'll say that very effective. I was able to attend one of those online even last year, and she uses her time very wisely, and there's laughter and there's tears and there's insights, and it's just so fun. In addition to your wisdom and just years of experience, you're a real fun person to be around too. So that's always fun and delightful. Yeah. And I always know that we're going to laugh about something good. So thank you so much for being here with us, Dr. Jennifer. Yeah. And best of luck, and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.